Hi, and welcome back to the Sunstone Fireside Podcast. This is your host, Lindsay Hansen Park. Today, I'm really honored to be interviewing a dear friend of mine, Sarah Burlingame. Sarah, can you say hello?
Hello. Thanks so much for having me, my dear friend, Lindsay Hansen Park.
So you and I have podcasted many times before, usually for the Feminist Mormon Housewives podcast or Year of Polygamy.
Yeah, back in the good old bad days.
But what's strange about that, what's strange about you being in Mormon spaces is you are not, nor have you ever been, a Mormon.
People keep telling me that. Yeah.
We're going to talk about why I'm interviewing a non-Mormon, but I also want to talk about who you are and what you do. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I am the executive director of Wyoming Equality. We do statewide LGBT advocacy. I am the representative for House District 44 here in Wyoming. I've got a really nice husband and three sons, and I like to bake bread, shoot guns, and go thrifting. So how am I not Mormon? I mean, how?
You're basically Mormon. I've preserved and canned pickles with you many times.
I can't really sew, though. So, I mean, I know maybe that's like too much of a reduction, but I can't.
But you do know all of the Book of Mormon stories, so that counts for something.
Yeah, I still haven't read the Book of Mormon, though, Lindsay. That's true.
I would like to extend a challenge and an invitation to you today.
Thank you. In my defense, I've tried, but I'm not kidding you. Like, there's a serious stupor of thought that happens. I just take it as the spirit.
Okay, so, and you're also, so you're director of Wyoming Equality. You're a legislator in the Wyoming legislature, which is awesome. I'm so proud of you.
Thank you, yeah. So, Lindsay and Grace and the kiddos all came out for my swearing in. It was super fun, and it was really great because when we had a little party that evening after the swearing in, Lindsay did a whole scrapbook where she'd gotten, like, Mormon feminists from all over to, like, write in, like, blessings and did it up scrapbook style, and then talked to, you know, my fellow legislators and other folks there about sharing her cultural heritage as a Utah, you know, Mormon woman, and this is how we celebrate things. And everyone was so charmed by it. Like Representative Connolly, who's our minority floor leader, and, you know, Mike Yun from Evan Jackson, were just like, that's amazing. We want to be friends with Mormon feminists now. Like, this is a good gig.
Good. I'm so glad that we represented our people well. So I want to talk to you about Matthew Shepard and Wyoming, because there's a Mormon element that a lot of people don't think about. And so I wanted to talk to you about that and the work that you're doing and how Mormons can help. But really quick, people are probably confused. How did you get involved in the Mormon community?
Sure. So, golly, what was it? 2006, I want to say. The HBO series Big Love was really taken off. And Bust Magazine, which is like a third wave feminist magazine, had Chloe Sevigny on the cover because she played the character on Big Love. And an article that was something like Desperate Mormon Housewives. And it was an article about FMH, Feminist Mormon Housewives. And it was Lisa Butterworth. It was Janet Garrard Willis. I think Emily Summerhays was in it. Maybe Rachel Lauritsen. Just a bunch of Mormon feminist women. And I just was really entranced, and so entranced that, like, my friends around the country were like, hey, Sarah, I read this article and it reminded me of you. I thought you would be really into it, which is really funny because, like, you know, not Mormon. Everything in Bust Magazine is feminist. And I wasn't a housewife. But I think people just understood that there's something about interesting intersections or things that, you know, other people might kind of like casually say that's oxymoronic or something that I find really compelling. And at home in. So yeah, found FMH, found all my homegirls. My kind of shorthand that I tell people, I just said this recently to someone that like I was adopted by a tribe of Mormon feminists. And I think actually there was a, he's a lobbyist and he didn't hear the feminist part or something. And he came back to me later and he was like, how do you know so much about Mormons? Like, why are you like versed in this? And I said, I told you I was adopted by a tribe of Mormon feminists in 2006. And the lobbyist was like, oh, you didn't say feminist. Oh, like, yeah, like, no, like, we don't have feminists. I was like, no, you definitely do. Let me tell you about them. Do you have a minute? Can I share a good word with you? Yeah, so that's kind of rambly, but adopted into the tribe, became the first non-Mormon to blog at Feminist Mormon Housewives. Went to my first Sunstone, I think, in 2008. I was really nervous about that. But yeah, and just kind of became immersed. Had Emerson, my seven-year-old, was blessed by my Mormon feminist sisters when he was, what was he, like 6 or 7 weeks old, Lindsay?
Yeah, just something a little like baby. That.
Yeah, just a tiny little peanut. Yeah, so I mean, I consider myself really immersed. I worked a lot with the church when I was working for the Human Rights Campaign, doing faith organizing. And the exclusion policy, which for what it's worth was, a name I gave it when it seemed like we were going to default to just calling it the new policy. And that seemed really wrong. And like it was erasing something.
You were the first person to coin the term.
Yeah, it felt like a really sort of Orwellian thing that like we weren't going to name it. And other people have given it other names, like POX, I think is a really good one. I can't remember any others off the top of my head. But that and Kate Kelly's, you know, our friend Kate's excommunication, I think those two things took a real toll in terms of how active and involved and engaged and maybe kind of optimistic I was about working within like the church structure. Although I had some dealings with the church in a very positive way and Utah Equality working on non-discrimination for Utah. And that was something I'm really proud of.
So you started as a blogger and now you're a politician in Wyoming. You're doing a lot of really amazing work for the LGBT community in Wyoming. That's why I wanted to bring you on today, because Matthew Shepard is a name most people probably know, but I don't think that they know the whole story. And I really wanted to explore the Mormon angles today so the Mormon audience can understand how Mormonism is involved. Why don't you walk us into an introduction on who was Matthew Shepard?
Sure. So Matthew Shepard was a Wyoming kid. His parents, Judy and Dennis, were both Wyoming folks. Dennis and I like to say that, we're so comfortable with each other because we're both trailer park kids. We grew up on the lower side of the economic scale. And as an adult, Dennis went to work in the oil fields and he got stationed over in Saudi Arabia. So he and Judy were in Saudi when they got the phone call that their son Matthew, who was a student at the University of Wyoming, had been found by a fence outside of Laramie, beaten and left to die. So the two men who attacked him, the young men, they were all young men, Matthew, Russell, and Aaron, were both Laramie kids themselves. Laramie is the college town here in Wyoming. It's 45 minutes from where I live in Cheyenne, the capital city. And the intersection of how folks responded to Matthew Shepard's murder. He survived for a few days and he died with his parents by his side in the hospital in Poudre Valley Hospital over in Fort Collins, which is 45 minutes away from both towns. And coincidentally where my middle son Atticus was born at that same hospital. And immediately it kind of captured the national attention because it was so very violent. And because Matthew, who had been born premature, had really struggled as an infant, was so diminutive, you know, he was just a tiny guy and young and sweet faced. And yeah, I think his murder just really captured the national attention. And in Wyoming, there was this sort of immediate defensiveness and hunkering down because the national media just kind of descended on Wyoming. And, you know, we weren't ready for it. And nobody's ever ready for it. We were spectacularly unready for it. And as soon as, you know, the message sort of coalesced that, like, well, this is the sort of thing that happens in Wyoming. You know, this is a backwoods place. And, you know, they murder gay kids here. We didn't really have a way to kind of do a yes and, you know, we didn't really have a way to say, like, yes, this could have happened anywhere and it happened here. And that says something about us. Probably one of the most articulate spokespeople and who was showing people a way forward and a way we could have dealt with it was actually the priest of the Catholic Church in Laramie at the Newman Center. I mean, he was on the record of just saying, like, hey, like, we've got to deal with this. Like, we've got to let this break our hearts. We've got to understand this. You know, we can do this. And I think people listened to him and then moved forward with the thing that they were going to do anyway, which was, it felt so shameful to have our state maligned by this murder and for people to think that that was somehow indicative of who we were. That, I mean, just everybody that I spoke to, and I moved here like 2 months before the murder happened, just shut down and just said, like, it wasn't us, it wasn't us, it wasn't us. And then when the trial, you know, happened, there was a little bit of sort of like, who are these men, you know, Russell and Aaron, like, who are these people who murdered this boy? You know, where did they come from? What was their motivation? Is there any chance it was just like, you know, a robbery gone wrong? Like who are they? And one of the stories that sort of, you know, like, that percolated up was their association with the church, with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And it was so kind of like, you know, I mean, one of them was an Eagle Scout, you know, and seemed to have a much firmer sort of what you would think was some sort of like moral grounding. But it's hard to have this conversation, Lynn, because on the one hand, you know, like, I think we're all learning from what happened in Christchurch and with like Jacinda Ardern and saying, well, do we want to focus that much on who the killers are? Like, you know, but I feel like with the Matthew Shepard, you know, story, kind of like the cat's already out of the bag. And rather than say, you know, Russell and Aaron, you know, specifically as two individuals, you know, who took part in the murder of this young man, like, we can't ever know, you know, exactly what was in their heart, but we can know where they went to church, where they went to school, and, you know, who sat at their dinner table, you know? And I feel like that's where I hope the conversation and its intersection, you know, with the church comes into play, and say, in all of those spaces, were they hearing a message that affirmed the worth and dignity of LGBT people? Or were they hearing a message that you could have excused someone from walking away from that and believing that they had tacit sort of permission to believe that gay people were less human, less deserving of love and dignity and value than someone who was straight or someone who's cisgender.
Yeah, and I appreciate that because this is in no way like a larger indictment of, you know, all Mormons or anything like that. That's not what we're saying. But you're right. I mean, when you talk about the murder, I understand that you're trying to be careful, but it was murder and torture. I mean, it wasn't just a killing. These people wanted this kid to suffer, and they ensured that he did. But I don't think that a lot of Mormons realize that one of his murderers was a Mormon kid. And like you said, I'm interested in...
Well, they both were.
Oh, they both were. They were both...
Well, I mean, they both attended. Only one was an Eagle Scout, but yeah.
So that is something we absolutely don't talk about. I remember this murder, and I remember even as a faithful Mormon who had a lot of homophobic ideas, I still thought it was horrific. I mean, it was undeniably a graphic, gruesome murder. So why don't we talk about, again, we don't want to make it about these guys and glorify what they did. But what do we know about motivations and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that you just spoke to, like, you know, we kind of gloss it by saying that a murder, but you're right. I mean, it was torture, and the murder itself was so vicious. I mean, they beat his skull in, you know, with a pistol and like disconnected, like, yeah, I mean, very gruesome. You know, the coroner and the police officer said, you know, what it looked like someone who had suffered the trauma of like a high impact car crash. It did not look like an assault. And I think, unfortunately, that's something that people have to bring up kind of over and over, because there is such an intense push to erase the violence of it and to collapse it into, you know, this had nothing to do with him being gay. You know, this was a robbery gone wrong. Well, that's not what a robbery gone wrong looks like. It just isn't. And, you know, the men who murdered him, you know, the reason why they wanted to, but were denied using the gay panic defense, you know, in court, was because that's how they conceptualized it, right? Like he was gay.
Okay, so so basically what happened was Matthew Shepard grew up in Wyoming. He was, by most accounts, a good kid. He was using drugs in college, right? And that would play into
So the coroner report was never released with the toxicology. But the woman who was the coroner at the time in Albany County, that's where Laramie is, about 6 months ago, she just said, hey, you know, it looks like it's circulating around again, this idea that, you know, it was a drug deal gone wrong. It was, you know, it had nothing to do with him being gay. So for what it's worth, I'm gonna release the coroner's report, you know, and sought permission and did that. No drugs in their system.
Well, that's for any of them. Okay, that's good to know, because the story that I think circulated was he was a gay kid who was living this deviant lifestyle, out being crazy, and he freaked out these two straight guys, allegedly straight guys, and they murdered him. As if, even if those facts were true, that would somehow justify what had happened to him. But what do we know? Can you walk us through that day?
Well, the book that came out actually said no. They knew each other from way back. They were involved in drug deals. You know, it was like a known sort of quantity. Of course, totally made up, totally nonsense, totally not corroborated. You know, I mean, you know, Matt was at the bar. They came into the bar. They were broke. They talked to him. They said, do you want to go someplace? He said, yes. He's going to go someplace with them. I don't know what he thought they were going to do, but he left willingly with them. They got in the truck. And at some point, they said, you know, this is a robbery. They said it was in response to Matt putting his hand on one of their knees, but they drove him outside of town. They tied him to a fence and they beat the life out of him in a pretty gruesome way. But here's what I think is super fascinating, Lindsay. And I don't remember if I told you about this at the time. But you know, the guy who wrote that book, who really reminds me of a lot of journalists that you have been in contact with, you know, the work you do with polygamy, right? Where they say like, I'm here to do, you know, like groundbreaking work, but really they're just looking to have, you know, some kind of hot take that separates them from the other journalists. You know, they're going to be the ones who blow the story open. They're going to be the ones who see a different angle and, you know, tell the real story. And it's not about like the real story. It's not about like what's actually happening. It's about like, how do I make my name, you know? And that's, I think, what this guy did. And he was coming on the anniversary of the 20th anniversary of Matthew's murder to just, you know, kind of desecrate the death of this, you know, innocent young man and say, oh no, you know, he was part of it. It was a drug deal. Everybody's trying to cover it up. The cops are covering it up, you know, all of this. And it was really shocking to me because I just thought like one of the things we do well in Wyoming, one of the things, you know, that is for what it's worth, like part of like Western values is like we protect our children, you know, and we have a pretty strong cultural sense of not desecrating the dead and like giving, you know, honoring people who, you know, who have died, particularly in really tragic ways. So, and mostly I saw that reflected, but, you know, when I didn't, when I saw people who were like, well, you know, like, let's teach both sides of the controversy, I just thought like, oh man, oh, if nothing else, like, how does it not like disgust you to not be a better neighbor, you know, like the shepherds are still just a family. They're still just, you know, like a mom and a dad who lost their kid in this very public, very tragic way. Like, how can you disrespect them so badly by like, you know, inviting someone into the town to, you know, make up these spurious claims about their child who's murdered. And, you know, so the guy came and he did some radio and I responded to it. You know, I also gave interviews. We had an event, you know, when the guy was doing a panel in Laramie. We kind of set up an alternative event at the same time called, and I'm very proud of this, When They Go Low, We Go Dance. It's just a dance party. Mm-hmm. Just send like, you know, if they're going to come and they're going to desecrate the memory of, you know, this son of Wyoming, you know, Matthew Shepard, and we're not going to engage it. We're just going to have a dance party, which I think is a really beautiful response to some pretty gross stuff. But as a result, like folks were, you know, attacking me online. And one of the guys who was attacking me was the guy who was kind of the main source in the book, you know, who'd said, who'd claimed that he was Matthew Shepard's boyfriend. He wasn't Matt's boyfriend. No one had ever seen him with him before. He'd claimed he was at Matt's bedside in the hospital as he was dying. Never happened. Was never there. His parents, Judy and Dennis, have never met him. And most like offensively, he claimed that Judy and Dennis gave him a vial with Matt's ashes and that he wears it as a necklace. So offensive. So gross. Never happened. Judy and Dennis never gave anybody any vial, right?
Yeah.
But that guy started coming online and saying that, like, yeah, Sarah Burlingame should be fired for Wyoming Equality. And someone else said, like, you should have that job. And he was like, yes, I'm downloading the form to be the president of Wyoming Equality right now. Like, what? Do you think we have a form online that says, would you like to be El Presidente of our organization? Would you like to replace? Please check here. You know, like, that doesn't exist. That's not a thing. But I just thought it was kind of amusing, right? Like, oh, this guy's delusional. I can't believe this is the source for, you know, this guy's terrible book. But then somebody else said, well, do you know why Sarah's saying that? It's because she's a drug user. It's because she participated in all this. And then you see these people say like, oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think I knew that. And it was really instructive to me to see it happen in like real time, to say like, how do those stories get validity? How did there ever come to be a, like, narrative that said, oh, it's about drugs. It was about, you know, this, oh, everybody kind of knows that. And I thought, oh, this is how it happens. I just watched it happen, like, in real time. Like, it has nothing to do with reality. It's obviously unverifiable because it never happened. But people like deflecting attention away from things that give them shame. And the fact that Matthew was murdered here, the fact that his murders sat through Sunday school lessons, sacrament meetings, and came away from that not knowing that gay lives had value, I think is something that gives us a lot of shame, and we don't know what to do with that.
That's helpful. And I think that it's interesting, so many of the things that you're saying, it's as if when this happened, people were trying to justify why it was okay, first of all. I mean, in any other scenario, a young college kid being murdered by his peers, it doesn't matter why they did it. It's that they did it.
Yeah. My sense of it was that in the first blush, right, like when the media descended, was that people in Wyoming said, look, that was Russell and Aaron. Those two were trouble. You know, they were trouble and they are no reflection on us. It was this idea that like, you know, they were born in a vacuum and they lived and they existed in this vacuum until the moment they created this murder. So they are no reflection of us, but they are monsters. You know, they are the scapegoats. We are going to heap all of our sins and our shame on them. We're going to lock them away in prison for a very long time. And we will never, ever acknowledge or look at how did those two men arrive in that place, in that truck with that idea? How did that happen? And then this book came out that said, oh, JK, it wasn't them. It was actually a drug deal gone wrong. State of Wyoming, everyone here is exonerated, you know. Really, it was the gay media, the gay agenda, you know, it was Bill Clinton, all trying to make us feel bad about something that we never should have had to feel bad about in the first place, because it turns out it never really happened. Just, you know, some drug dealers doing drugs, dying the way drug dealers do. Obviously deeply problematic, right?
Right.
Even if that story was true, that like you can't throw a stone and find a family in Wyoming who's not been affected by someone in their family or circle having a problem with methamphetamines. Like, it is a Wyoming problem. And the idea that like the end result of that is like, well, some of them get murdered. No, they don't. Lots of us have friends or family members who have had problems with drugs. And then they get clean. They get help. You know, they get a job that they have to, you know, stay sober for, whatever. They don't get murdered. They don't get murdered, you know. So there's a disconnect even with that. And that's a pretty shoddy story as well.
Hi, I'm Stephen Carter. Since 1975, Sunstone Magazine has been publishing the best of Mormon thought and experience. And now, Sunstone is also a podcast where you can listen to audible quality recordings of our best articles, essays, stories, and poetry, both new and classic. Come get a taste with our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone. We look forward to being a part of your journey.
Do you want to talk about what we know about root causes? Is that helpful, do you think?
I don't know about root causes so much as like, it's so hard to have a nuanced conversation about this, because the second you bring up the fact, you know, that, one of them not only like was raised in the church, but my understanding is, you know, I mean, he's at the prison in Rawlins here. One is in Rawlins and one is in Mississippi, because we do not have enough bed space in Wyoming for all of our prisoners. And my understanding is that, you know, he is a good prisoner and has started being visited by the home teachers again. And
so he's
is seeking
still,
that out.
He's still a faithful Mormon.
I don't know about still. I mean, I think at the time of the murder, I don't think he would have considered himself an active believing member, but he has been in prison for almost 20 years now. And my understanding is that he is considers himself part of the church now.
Okay. So has he shown remorse? Has he changed his mind?
Yeah, I mean, part of this guy who came out, you know, for the 20th anniversary, one of the things that he wanted to do was, you know, a jailhouse interview that was sort of like Skyped in live to this event that he was having. The only problem was he didn't tell the Department of Corrections that he was intending to do that. And I don't know if he thought he was just going to like sneak a camera crew in or what. But obviously it was turned down, you know, like Wyoming very wisely doesn't allow their, you know, prison services to be turned into sort of like reality TV spectacle. So that's good. And never mind like the obscenity of saying like on the actual anniversary of the murder, we're going to Skype in the murderer, you know, to talk about why we have it wrong. But he did interview him, as well as the Associated Press. And really, you know, like the takeaway, my takeaway from that, you know, was, I think they were trying to get him to say that, you know, it had nothing to do with being gay or something. And he didn't say it, you know, that he wouldn't, you know, confirm that. So I think that speaks to something.
What has the response been like from the Mormon community now to you, to Wyoming Equality, to the anniversary of Matthew's death? And I also want to talk about the cool experience that you had with Judy Shepherd at some point too.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's a mixed bag, right? Like, I mean, I think my Mormon friends who have like processed this a little bit more can kind of speak to like that they feel, you know, some shame. There was also a pretty high profile in Wyoming case where a man who was a member of the church really severely beat and raped a woman in her home, and his former bishop wrote a letter to the court during the sentencing asking for leniency, kind of speaking to, you know, having been this man's Sunday school teacher and, you know, bishop and everything, and said, you know, this should be seen as an isolated incident of like, you know, a good young man who made a mistake sort of thing. And then that former bishop was running for governor, and this the letter that he had written to the court was leaked, and that kind of brought into the public attention this idea of like, oh, like if you're a religious leader, like what is your responsibility? Because he kind of said like, I had to write that letter, you know, I was asked and I had to, and everyone was like, well, you didn't have to write that letter. Like that was kind of and I think, you know, this is not specific to Mormons, but I think it's pretty universal. But like when that happens, I think most people here just feel deeply, deeply defensive, you know, like they want to say like, yeah, so he was Mormon, you know, like that doesn't mean anything. Like we don't have any practice of saying, you know, yes, he could have been a member of any faith or none. You know, this violent crime is not like, that's Mormon for you, you know. There is nothing special or, you know, indicative of violence to any particular religious group. And you can still say, and it happened in ours. So since it happened in ours, how are we going to address that? You know, like what kind of, are we giving clear messages? Yeah, I had a particularly awful experience with a man who's a former bishop and someone I worked with in the past in Laramie. We were meeting for breakfast and to talk about this, to talk about the 20th anniversary, to talk about how Laramie was going to respond. And he said repeatedly, like 5 times in a row, after having a very good, very open, you know, conversation for like an hour and a half with each other, he just kind of blurted out, Matthew wasn't innocent. He wasn't innocent, Sarah. But you know Matthew wasn't innocent. Sarah, Matthew wasn't innocent. He wasn't innocent. And it was just so shocking. It felt so compulsive. And like he had to say, you know, I mean, just kind of classic sort of like Rene Girard sort of like scapegoating stuff. But like, if I can say, you know, the victim was not innocent and that the victim was complicit, then like my hands are clean, you know, and that was deeply, deeply, deeply disappointing.
Yeah, it's disappointing. And it's something that I still see as a Mormon in this community. I mean, we will talk about the instances of LGBT suicides in Utah, and people are looking for all the reasons to not say that it's Mormon related, right?
Right, right, right. Yeah, very, very similar, right? And it's that same thing, right? It's like, it could happen anywhere. Like, okay, but it's not. It's happening here, you know? Like, well, lots of faiths, you know, teach what our church does or something. Like, it makes reason stare. See, I mean, it just kind of, like, confounds me that, like, whatever defensiveness you have, like, wouldn't you lay it down if you thought it was contributing to children dying, you know, like, yeah, it's really sad.
Yeah. I mean, I've talked very openly about this tension between faith and loyalty in Mormonism. And sometimes, and I think a lot of times people conflate the two and they think that it's more important to be loyal to the institution than to do the right thing. And there's this deeply embedded, and I would say, historically relevant trend in Mormonism where we protect our own first, we protect the institution. And of course, that's not exclusive to Mormonism. But as we talked about with sex abuse and things like that, why wouldn't we want to make our communities better? I mean, we're not the City of Enoch yet, right? But we want to think that we are. So what can Mormons who are listening, who do care, who do see the connectiveness to our culture and our theology and our doctrine in how we, you know, participate and engage LGBT issues, what can those Mormons do?
I think recognize maybe the spaces where, you know, we feel defensive and kind of recognize when we're having that, like, that tug of, like, but that's not fair, you know? And recognize that, you know, Judy and Dennis don't get their son back, you know, like no matter what kind of good comes out of their advocacy, comes out of, you know, helping to pass the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Hate Crimes Act, what comes out of, you know, organizing around the country and around the world, like for greater acceptance of not just like LGBT issues, but like, you know, ableism and all kinds of, you know, diversities. Like whatever good work they do, they don't get their son. And what they want is their son. And like, so for Mormons who struggle with like seeing any sort of like connectedness to this, I would just like urge you to step away from seeing this as a sort of a political talking point and like what you may have heard of like the spectacle or the stories or the drama around like the Matthew Shepard murder, and just connect back with, you know, the reality that like Matt was their son and Judy and Dennis and, you know, their other son, they wish they had their son, you know, like that's what they want. And just that finality of murder, you know, that like it's gone, it's done. I reached out to Judy recently to say, hey, we're going to be showing this movie at the library in Casper. We're showing Matthew Shepard is a friend of mine. Matt Shepard is a friend of mine. This great documentary that was done by a friend of his that he went to boarding school in Switzerland with, Michelle. And we're showing them all over libraries around Wyoming. And we think that like this movie is a great way of like reminding people that like, look, he was just a kid. He was just a guy. He was a kid who like loved politics, loved political science, really engaged, really like funny and kind and goofy, like really goofy, you know, like strip back this, you know, political talking point that might have like infested, you know, how you think about this and just remember, you know, that this is a person, this is a kid. And so I asked Judy, like, oh, do you, you know, it's going to be in your town, it's going to be in Casper, do you want to go to that? Or, you know, like, I didn't want to have it in her town and not invite her. And Judy wrote back and she just said, oh, no, like, I would never go to that. That would be too hard. I can't watch that movie. Like, it's too hard for me. And, you know, I just think like, oh, even I forget, right? Right? That like, you know, they do such big, important advocacy and they talk about this all the time. But at the end of the day, like she's a grieving mom, you know, like to go and be in a room with people and see her son, you know, as a teenager, like, you know, laughing and being alive. It's just too hard for her. Yeah. That's, I think, what I want people to remember, you know, like, how would you want, if this was your son, you know, if this was your family member, how would you want him to be spoken of?
Sarah, this is a little forward, but would you be comfortable giving a little bit of the opening of your speech that you delivered?
Oh, for Judy?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, we can just link it in the thing. So I introduced Judy at the Matthew Shepard Gala, which was a huge honor, you know, like, man, Judy Shepard. Like, I just love her. And Dennis. And Dennis, oh man, he kills me. Like, Dennis is your dad. Like, he is everybody's dad. Like, he is, like, he's so rough around the edges. Judy, like, dies a little when she sees him get up to take a microphone because, like, he's never on somebody else's message. He's always on Dennis's message. And like, he says really shocking things. He makes terrible dad jokes. He's like, he can be really abrasive, you know, and like, just says the thing that he sees because, you know, he's a Wyoming oil guy. And such a dad, you know, like at the last, for the 20th anniversary, you know, Lindsay, like I do, like I left my purse in like one of the conference rooms and I was out talking to folks, but, you know, Dennis went in and he found my purse and he brought it to me. Another time we were at a vigil at the university and I kicked my shoes off because I was wearing high heels and they weren't comfortable. And Dennis had left. It was like 10 o'clock at night and he had to drive to Casper. He had to get up early in the morning to shovel the walk for Judy, or he said she was mad at him. But like, he came back because he like saw my shoes and he wanted to like return my shoes to me. And he just has all of these little actions that are like just what a dad does. And like every time I just get so heartbroken because I just think like he's missing, you know, half of his children, you know,
yeah.
Like he's a dad. He doesn't have that kid. Yeah. So let's just link to the Judy thing. But if we can, I'd love to share the poem that I wrote because I traveled back to D.C. with the Shepherds and a bunch of, you know, Wyoming folks and folks from all over because his ashes were laid to rest at the National Cathedral there in Washington, D.C., which was really, really bittersweet for me because obviously it was a huge honor but also obviously there was a reason that they could not be laid to rest in Wyoming. And it was that, you know, 20 years on, we just haven't made that progress. And, you know, Judy and Dennis were afraid that his grave would be desecrated or, you know, used for something. So, yeah. So he was laid to rest at the cathedral.
And we were so proud of you, our little non-Mormon feminist blogger who got to go accompany them to this important thing, and you delivered a really beautiful speech.
Yeah, the Wyoming Art Party, who are amazing, they helped us make this shawl because, like, we wanted to, you know, we knew that, like, everyone couldn't, like, fly out to D.C., but we really wanted Wyoming to be represented there. So people from all over the state sent us their names and what town they were from. And so Wyoming Art Party made this silk sort of shawl with these like angel wings on it. I'll send you a picture of it and put everybody's names on it. And so I wore the shawl as I traveled to D.C. And this is the poem that I wrote for it. Dear Matthew, my sons went to the garden before sunrise to scoop up handfuls of dirt. Cradled in a Ziploc bag as I make my way through security at Denver International Airport. You remember DIA, but it's different now. You wouldn't recognize it. People stare at me. I'm wearing the shawl Adrian made with hundreds of names from dozens of Wyoming towns. Who are we kidding, Matt? Ethity, Bondurant, Wilson. What's smaller than a town? It's that. My Mormon sisters taught me to carry names into sacred spaces. Dirt, names, and a prayer in Lakota. Leha sent me. I say carry, but I mean it, the way the Laramide orogeny carried what became Vitavu. Carry the way your mother carried you, tenderly. If we're going to be honest, I'm carrying sorrow with me too, and a copy of Antigone in my back pocket, reminding me of all the things we owe the dead, of all the ways we failed to honor you. My shawl makes me a little absurd. Dear Matt, I am willing to be absurd for you. Isn't that a tidy definition of love? I just want to say one last time before you are laid to rest in a cathedral far from home, we traded all to have you. Love, Sarah.
That is so beautiful, Sarah. Thank you for writing it.
That's still really hard, right? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. It feels like that is a wound that, like, does not heal up.
I don't know that wounds like that heal until progress changes and people change.
Yeah, I think it's part of, like, from the very second it happened, like, we were fighting. Like, we were fighting to carve out, like, some dignity and, like, some perspective. And it's like, oh, well, that's not mourning. You know, like, we didn't just get to mourn him. And that's the space where, like, maybe if there's a place, like, you know, for our Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, brothers and sisters, to, like, walk with us, it's there to say, do we or do we not mourn with those who mourn? Okay, well, come and mourn with us, because this was a really beautiful kid and his life was lost. And, you know, the two men who murdered him, they should have had a life in front of them as well. You know, those lives were lost too because they committed a murder. You know, could we do better?
So, Sarah, how can people support you, your work, Wyoming Equality, and the legacy of Matthew Shepard?
Yeah, I mean, you can check out the Matthew Shepard Foundation. I mean, Judy does really amazing things. We'll link here to the introduction I did at the Matthew Shepard Foundation Gala, where we talk about, like, the work that Judy does. If folks want to support Wyoming Equality, if you want to send us a little message, this would be a great week to do it. It has been a doozy. It has been rough. Just white supremacy and armed men and all kinds of nonsense. So if you want to send us a note, we would love it. you want to become a donor because you think it's good work, do that. Support Sunstone, support the people who support us. I guess the biggest thing you could do is just lay down that defensiveness too and say, what stories are we telling ourselves about whose lives have worth and dignity? And just look at our culture, our community, we are formed by the stories we tell around the dinner table, in our churches, and in our schools. And what kind of stories are being told in those spaces?
That's really beautiful. I appreciate you and the stories that you're telling and the way that you are persistently and consistently giving people dignity of all spaces. And I appreciate that you've done that for your Mormon brothers and sisters as well.
Well, I love my peculiar people. So thanks for being a storyteller who lifts up all the good stories, Lynn.
So I'm sending the missionaries over, as always.
Yeah, I got to tell you, serving in the legislature with some of my new, very conservative, very Mormon fellow legislators, I love their guts. They're such good people, such good men. Really, really, I feel so grateful that I got grafted into this weird, Mormon family. But one of my colleagues, I'm not going to say his name, I would he'd start to talk about something and I would say, yeah, do you know the history about that? Because I'm friends with Lindsay Hanson Park. So I know me some Mormon nerd history. And my colleague would just look at me and say, Carol, why aren't you Mormon? You should be Mormon. Come on over. Oh, I'll be your friend from over here. You need friends outside of faith too.
When I get all the Mormon I need when I stay at Lindsay's house.
Yeah. I'm all filled up. Yeah. Thanks for having me on the podcast, Lindsay, and thanks for letting me talk about Matt, because I do think his story really matters. And, it's a real shame that folks have tried to, co-opt it and make it ugly. But we have the power, to lift his story up and do right by his family.
Well, thank you for coming on and sharing that and sharing your poem and for being such a great example to so many of us. Thanks, Sarah.
That's what I'm here for. Thanks so much, Lynn.
The song you are listening to is titled Nostrand Avenue by Mormon artist Belle Jewell. You can support her and other amazing Mormon artists by downloading her album End of an Era by Belle Jewell or find her on Spotify.